found the Digging Oak Island podcast, the podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm David Pride. Thank you so much for downloading and listening. If you have been listening to and enjoying our podcast, please help out the show by leaving us a 5-star rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or, you know, wherever you get your podcasts, and you can leave a rating. Also, I invite you to join us on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow the show at Digging Oak Island. Let's start the show by answering a few emails from you guys. Our first one comes from a listener named Jesse, who writes, "My neighbor told me about the podcast, and so I gave it a listen. He was spot on with the recommendation. I really enjoy the podcast." First of all, let me stop here. Thank you so much for the kind words, and especially if you can pass on a big thank you to your neighbor for sharing the podcast with you. I mean, maybe your neighbor's listening now. If you are, thank you so much. Folks, if you know any Oak Island fans out there, please, please, please share the show with them. Anyway, Jesse continues. "What are your thoughts of the human bones found? Also, does it prove that a treasure of some sort is there because of the depth the bones were found at? How do you think they got down there?" So what Jesse is referring to here, I'm pretty sure at least, is specifically two small fragments of human bones discovered by the current team during season 5 of the Curse of Oak Island television show. Both of these pieces were pulled out of an exploratory drill hole in the Money Pit area, the team called H8, and discovered while searching the spoils from that hole on a sorting table. Now, if I'm not mistaken, they were each found on separate occasions, I think maybe an episode 2 apart, and each at a depth of around 150 to 160 feet or so, much further down in the ground than one would naturally expect to find something like that. Later in the season, they were both scientifically dated to the time period of the late 17th and early 18th centuries, right around that time of the turn of the 18th century, using carbon dating, if I'm not mistaken. I don't always remember exactly what they used here, but I think it was carbon dating. And I think they also had a separate expert do some DNA testing, and they determined that one of the bones came from a person of Middle Eastern origin, while the other was of European origin. So it's bones from two different people. Now, your question was, does this prove that there is a treasure on Oak Island? How did these bones get down there? Jesse, at the risk of sounding a tad snarky, and that's not at all my intention here, but if I could answer those questions, you can bet your life I would be in the war room on the next episode telling this all to Rick and Marty. So what are the possible logical explanations for finding these bones 150 feet underground on an island in Nova Scotia? Honestly, there are really precious few logical explanations here. We know that the second person who ever died while working on the island, a man named Maynard Ferguson, fell to his death straight into the Money Pit in 1897. Now, I'm not 100% certain of this, and please email me if I'm wrong, but I've seen conflicting reports. I think his body was found and removed from the shaft. Some people say it isn't. So it's likely not his remains, but I guess there still is that possibility. Like I said, there seems to be some conflicting reports about whether or not Ferguson's remains might still be down there, but most of the information says no. Now, even so, that's still only one guy, not two, and the dates here obviously don't match up with what we know of these two bone fragments that we're speaking of. Now, for a slightly less specific and yet still somewhat plausible explanation here, or I guess explanation, there is just the obvious state of the ground in the Money Pit area to discuss. Years and years of bulldozers, dynamite, cave-ins, dug up and filled back in, all the rest does make the depth a little, I don't know, suspect, if that's the word. I mean, just because that's where it was found a couple of years ago does not at all mean that that's where it originally was put into the ground in the 18th century. So could this have just started its underground journey at a much shallower depth and then worked its way down over the years? Sure. In fact, that seems like a pretty likely scenario to me, all things considered. But again, what does that tell us? As Rick Lagina likes to say, these bones are just another example of more Oak Island evidence that just leads to, you know, more questions than answers. And finally, with regards to whether or not finding these bones proves there's a treasure down there, honestly, I just don't ever really think along those lines. I'm just always hesitant to make kind of that leap of faith from a piece of evidence. What I mean is, at this point, it's only proof to me that the team found bones at a depth in the Money Pit area that doesn't seem to belong there for a variety of reasons. To me, the only proof of a treasure is when they actually find that treasure. Let me conclude by saying again that I can come up with logical explanations as to why they might have ended up so deep. Also, despite the likely incorrect notion that Oak Island was completely uninhabited before 1795, there certainly were Europeans in that area of Nova Scotia in the decades around the late 17th and early 18th centuries. And perhaps two of the settlers were buried on the island for whatever reason, and there's no records of that. That's very logical. But once you put the two pieces of evidence together, the depth, the origin, the dating information, and you have a real head scratcher here. There's no doubt about that. Anyway, I know that's not an answer to your question, at least not a complete one, but that's the best I have for you. Our next email comes from Mark in Canada. He writes, "Hi, Dave. First of all, thanks for making the podcast. It's nice to hear some reason opposed to the lot of the crazy stuff the show wants us to believe. Ever since Dan Brown's book, Templars seem to be a hot topic in the History Channel. Has a full-on insert expletive here." It's a family show there, Mark. For everything Templar related. Man, he's not wrong about that, that's for sure. I wanted you and other listeners' opinion on something. There seems to be quite a disparity in the dates of objects found on the island. For example, if I remember correctly, the bone fragments date from the 16th or 17th centuries. As we were just discussing, it was a little later than that, but you're close. The swamp doctor said the swamp was created sometime around the 1680s to 1700s. And even within the Smith's Cove, the structures vary in date. That is also correct. The slipway was dated to 1769, while one of the other structures, was it the mysterious L-shaped contraption? Came back with a 1741 dating. It might have been the U-shape, actually. Depending on what the theory, the annoying narrator is pushing, one or the other is more prevalent in the episode at hand. That's still a 30-year time span between the two, so which one is it? I find it hard to believe it took them 30 years to construct whatever it is they were constructing. Not to mention, there must have been a healthy population in the area by the time the 1770s came around. There was, we just discussed that. I don't want to speculate on who did all the work, but maybe the original works were done in the late 17th, early 18th century, and the slipway was constructed years later when the powers that be came back for their hidden goods. Maybe Samuel Ball found some of the leftovers, who knows? It does seem to me that while something obviously was done on the island in the past 200 years, very little to indicate that treasure has been found. Stuff that has been found often seems apocryphal at best and embellished to attract investors. As for any documents or manuscripts, surely after centuries of digging, drilling, and tunneling would destroy any book carrying vessels, the contents left exposed to the elements and seawater. Anyhow, keep up the good work. All the best, Mark in Calgary. Thanks, Mark. It's a great email. I have to tell you, Mark, even though I didn't read that very well, and I'm sorry about that, but when I sit down with friends, you know, at a bar with a pint and we're talking about Oak Island, I sound a lot like you do in this email, admittedly. What is so darn confounding about this hunt, what compels us all to keep reading, keep watching, and some to keep digging, is pretty much that the same because of the same conclusion you're drawing in this email, really. Something obviously was done on the island. We seem to know that now. But as you are alluding to, no matter what seems to be found, no matter how out of place or extraordinary some artifact might seem, I hate to say it again, but we seem to only get more questions and precious few answers, even 8 years or 7 years into this show and, you know, 200 plus years into the hunt. Literally dozens of theories seem to make some sense, but none of them seem to make enough sense for me to call it convincing. It's maddening, really. Let's get right down to it. In my mind, the evidence we have now seems to point towards two rather large and very separate time frames, one more so than the other. The most likely being the colonial period in North America, which is roughly defined as like 1607, which was the year of the founding of the Jamestown colony, right up to or just really before the breakout of the American Revolution, sometime around 1770 in that area. It is, I admit, a big time frame. That's over 160 years of history. And this theory is certainly not a groundbreaking theory on my part. Nobody's going to ask me to write a paper on this. But it seems the most likely period for us at least to be looking at and focusing our attention on at this moment. It involves everything, really. I mean, all the suspects, Freemasons, pirates, the French, the English, Francis Bacon, and so on and so on and so on. And as you say, the most recent hard evidence also seems to be pointing us towards that period as well. And if I were to narrow it all down a bit, I would say specifically the middle of the 18th century seems to be the part where we're getting the most information now. Now, I suppose a distant second would be the late medieval period, and I'm thinking like in and around the 14th century, the Templar Age, so to speak. Besides the lead cross and other pieces of lead found that date to the same time, coupled with, you know, the work of Zena Halpern and many others, there seems to be mounting evidence of a possible Templar voyage to North America during this time. But like I've said many times in the past, this evidence isn't anywhere near as concrete as some scholars would like it to be. So therefore, this is all still very much in the realm of speculation. So while we know Europeans were in Nova Scotia during the colonial period, it is still really, you know, not much more than a guess if they were there in the medieval period. So until we get what I would call concrete proof of a Templar voyage to North America during the period that when the Templars were existed and at the height of their power, I'd have to rate that time frame, this medieval time frame, as nothing more than a distant second at best, no matter what this evidence like the cross and stuff might say. The problem here is exactly what you said, Mark. The History Channel way overrates the Templar connection for whatever reason. Despite the evidence that we're gaining now, they still want to mention the Templars as much as they possibly can. But even still, so many variables seem to be perpetually in play here. You named a number of them, such as did Samuel Ball find the treasure himself? Did whoever dug the money pit already come back and retrieve it sometime before 1795? If not, has it all been destroyed by the incredible amount of destruction the last 2+ centuries of searchers have caused under the ground on Oak Island? It's an endless cycle of doubt and determination, really. And after all of the reading, watching, and talking I've done, I'm really no closer to getting behind any one theory than I was 20 years ago. That's a great email, Mark. Thank you. Let's head across the pond to Rob in London, who writes, "Here in the UK, we have a different guy doing the narration." He has a deadpan Northern England accent and sounds a lot better and far more enjoyable than the guy that you get. Shame you don't get to hear him also. Also, at the start of each season, we have to endure that Maddie guy that you get. Geez, how often do you have to put up with him? Well, Rob, not much. We get a couple of shows with Maddie Blake. I have no particular issue with Maddie Blake. I think he's a little, you know, he's very cheery and he loves what he does. He's very enthusiastic. I have no particular issue with him. I know a lot of people do, but I like him. I know he's not he's not an honest broker as far as he doesn't ever think the skeptic way or anything like that. I understand that, but that's not what he's there to do. I think you're also making a lot of U.S. and Canadian viewers very jealous that you guys over there don't have to endure the dulcet tones of the great Robert Clotworthy, who's the name of the narrator. Now, having said that, if there are two complaints I am honestly a little sick of hearing about from fans, it is the constant repeating of information done by the editors. People do not like that, where they go back and tell you what happened yesterday or, you know, the last show or even 20 minutes ago. And also the borderline silly narration of Robert Clotworthy. Now, I can't say I disagree with either of the complaints. I guess I just kind of learned to look past them to some degree, although I'll get to that at the end of this podcast. Sometimes I can't look past it. Just the other day, I was talking about this with a friend of mine who can't stand the narrator either. And I answered his question of why doesn't it bother me by comparing it kind of to my love of Bob Dylan. I understand Dylan is not the greatest vocalist in the world and that his singing sometimes turns folks off, certain people. But the content of his songs, the incredible lyrics, the great melodies he writes, the great arrangements, make it easy for me to kind of look past past all that and love his music despite his vocal, I guess, limitations is the word to say. I get it. Clotworthy and the writers. Now, really, we have to mention the writers. Can't just blame Clotworthy for all this. He's only reading this nonsense. He ain't writing it. The two of them can be very annoying. Maybe I can, find a way to give the British version a try from now on. Maybe it's on YouTube. I don't know. Thanks, Rob. Great email. Touches on the heart of a lot of complaints that people of this show have, or certainly one particular complaint that we hear a lot. Now, I have a lot of emails this week, and I know I'm running long here, but I felt since most of us are at home more than usual now, myself included, with all the lockdowns and stuff, I thought we would just keep all of these emails in the podcast. They're all good. And it kind of gives us, you know, it gives us a long show, but I think it can, you know, we can offer up as much Oak Island content as possible this week, maybe to help pass the time or brighten up things a bit for you at home. So we will get to this week's episode, reviewing it in just a second. But until then, let's continue with the emails. Our next one is from Charlie, who writes, on your most recent episode, you discussed the pave area in the swamp and mentioned it may have been placed there by local indigenous people who may have been mining clay on the island. I would like to think this is a distinct possibility, except for the fact that I don't think the Mi'kmaq people would have had horses or carts and therefore no need of a paved road. I'm just supposing here, since I have no real knowledge of these people or how these people lived or what resources they may have had. I am what you might consider a hopeful skeptic on the subject of the Oak Island treasure. I'd love for them to find a fabulous treasure, but I'm somewhat doubtful that there is anything there. I think it's most likely that the activity on the island is the result of mining operations or ship repair. If there is or was ever treasure on the island, I believe it was most likely of the pirate variety and that it was most likely long gone. Anyway, keep up the great work, and I look forward to your next episode. I also love how so many listeners to the show have so many different ideas of what it might be. I love to hear those. Charlie, first, I just want to say it wasn't my idea that the paved road was put there specifically for the use of horses and carts. That came from, I think, the archaeologist on site, whose name was Aaron Taylor. It was either him or it was the swamp doctor, Ian Spooner, who said that specifically. And I only repeated it because, you know, certainly I agreed with the idea that this was at least one possible purpose for building this paved area. It seems to make sense, but it doesn't have to be specifically for just horses and carts. Now, listen, I'm not going to even attempt to try and sound like an expert on Mi'kmaq culture here. I'm sure they had horses and carts of some kind at some point in their history, but I have no idea when, and I have no idea, you know, for what purpose they used them or when they started to use them. But I'm not sure that that really matters. The idea is the ground was just too soft to carry heavy loads of, you know, soggy clay without sinking into the ground up to your knees. Heck, it might have been too soft to even get out there and start digging in the first place. Thus, the need for the paved area for at least some stability. I think that analysis makes sense regardless of whether horses or carts were ever in the picture. The swamp is fresh water. It may very well be spring-fed to some extent. I'm pretty sure it is. We get very little talk about that. So even though it might be a lot bigger now than it was back then, or at least we can say it has changed in some significant way, we could still, even back then, be talking about an area of what was very soft ground, kind of a boggy area. And that could be hazardous to walk around with, you know, heavy stuff. Does that make sense? And also, Charlie, the last part where you said, quote, I think it's most likely that the activity on the island is the result of mining operations or ship repair. All I'll say is this. I'm just not as sure as you are about that at this point in time. But that very same idea is certainly gaining traction in the world of Oak Island researchers and theorists. There's a lot of stuff coming out about that now. Although you would never know it from watching the show. Thanks, Charlie. Now let's go on to Tim, who says, your podcast is still the best Oak Island podcast. Had to keep that in, guys. Sorry. It's just flattery will get you everywhere. I have been thinking lately about the big picture. The TV show makes me dizzy with all the crazy ideas it presents. I love watching the show, but sometimes it seems like they take us over here to examine this one little thing, and then yank us over there to consider something else. And other times, they seem to have a theory of the week. At this point, I think we should be zeroing in, not constantly casting a wider net. So what I'm thinking about is lately is the original story of Daniel McGinnis and the big picture of what we know now. When the money pit was first described, it seems to have been left undisturbed for several years, like maybe for a decade or so, but not centuries. Do you agree? If that is the case, then it would seem to be something that the English or French would have done, especially with the dendro testing the show has done on a few wood samples. Your thoughts? Thanks, Tim. Okay, Tim. Unfortunately, this is really another question I only wish I had the answers to, but in fact, I don't. And listeners, I apologize for that. I keep answering these emails without real answers. But what I absolutely love about the questions like this is that you really can't answer them. And this, you know, they make us all do some serious sort of Oak Island contemplating. And I bring up things for us to talk about and think about that are almost never discussed on the show. So, on to the very nebulous subject of the discovery of the money pit. There is literally nothing about this event that isn't debated in some form or another by Oak Island researchers and fans and theorists. For instance, not only do people debate why Daniel McGinnis was on the island in the summer of 1795 and exactly how old he might have been when he did find the money pit, there are even some folks out there who doubt whether Daniel McGinnis actually ever existed in the first place. I believe this second Dig in Oak Island podcast I ever published was on this very subject of the discovery of the money pit. The long and short of it is this: no one really has any earthly clue what exactly he saw and what he thought of it. If we indeed accept the fact that there was a Daniel McGinnis and he was alive and well and on Oak Island in 1795, and that he did indeed discover an impression in the ground with trees around it, which some say appeared to have something carved on them, and a block and tackle hanging overhead from one of these branches hanging over the depression, the fact still remains that we have absolutely no records of that from Daniel McGinnis himself. He never wrote down or kept any notes or thoughts at all or anything. Never spoke to a reporter or an author, nothing like that. Nothing that I can find. If I'm wrong, point me in the right direction, please. There are no letters that I can find from McGinnis to any of his friends or loved ones where he talks about this life-changing moment in 1795. In fact, the first written reports of the discovery of the money pit don't really even show up until decades later. So all we know from these early reports, the ones that were written decades later, goes something like this. And what I'll do here is I'll read, and there are a few of these, but I'll read from the first ever newspaper report of the Money Pit's discovery published by the Liverpool Transcript in 1862. That's right, 1862, 67 years later. And like I said, if you want to know more about this and the genesis of what I'm reading here, go back and listen to that podcast I did very early on. I think it's episode 2 or something like that. It says McGinnis, quote, discovered the spot in question from its being sunken and from the position of three oak trees, which stood in a triangular form round the pit. The bark had letters cut into it with a knife on each tree facing the pit, and one of the trees being so directly over the pit that two large branches formed a crotch, were exactly perpendicular to the center and had a hole bored through, and an oak tree nail driven in, on which hung a block and tackle. He was induced from the appearance to suppose that it might be the place referred to by the sailor. Now here he's talking about a legend of a sailor who knew of Captain Kidd's treasure. Okay, and this is where it was buried. Now, you could see just in there how unspecific all that is. Now, with great detail, they can describe how the block and tackle was hung, but nobody knows what the letters were carved into the tree? I mean, this is, you'll go crazy reading about this. Now, Nova Scotia in the 18th century being what it was, a very maritime place to say the least, naturally McGinnis and everyone else, not just because of these stories, must have thought and just assumed really that this was the work of pirates. This is a time, you know, where legends of pirates were prevalent anywhere near the coast. But is that conclusion that this was pirates only due to the presence of maybe the block and tackle and, of course, the local pirate lore? It's impossible to say. Did something carved in the tree make him think it was pirates? I've read some reports that this block and tackle essentially disintegrated in their hands as they removed it, thus hinting that it was quite old indeed and hadn't been touched in ages. But those are unverified reports. Here in this first newspaper report, that's not mentioned. Did these supposed carvings or how it was dug or anything like that, any of that give them an idea of age or origin? I mean, you know, carvings on the tree fades over time. So even if they couldn't read the carvings, could they have given us some information of what they looked like? No, we have no idea. No accurate record of it at all. And certainly none from McGinnis. Having said all that, I do agree that we need to focus our attention, we mentioned this before, you know, much more than the channel than the History Channel has. But I hardly think that the History Channel and Prometheus are ever going to do that anytime soon. Listen, like we said earlier, the History Channel loves the Knights Templars. They just can't quit those guys. And apparently neither can Gary Drayton, let's be honest. But so even though all of the serious hard evidence coming recently from this very hunt, from this very show, seems to point to the mid-18th century, centuries past the existence of the Knights Templars, I just don't think the History Channel is going to let the Templars go down without a fight. For whatever reason, they must have a good reason. They think they need the Templar connection as part of this show for ratings, I guess. Anyway, thanks again, Tim. Great email. Now, let's finish up with Steve, who writes a long email, but a really good one. This might get a bit tough to follow, but let's see. He writes, "Something I've been wondering recently is, to what degree are the things shared on the show really contemporaneous new discoveries? Let me give you an example. Prompted by a mention in one of your previous podcasts of the documentary Cracking the Shakespeare Code, which, by the way, for your listeners, is available on Amazon Prime Video, I watched the documentary a few nights ago. In the documentary, Dr. Robert Crumpton and Norwegian researcher Petter Amundsen explore what on the Curse of Oak Island is often referred to as the Baconian theory, that Sir Francis Bacon may have wrote some or all of Shakespeare's works, and that the original manuscripts of these works may be hidden on Oak Island. Now, follow this train of thought. Per IMDb, the documentary was released on January 9th, 2017. Presumably, the content was recorded in the period of 2014 to 2016 because Crumpton and Amundsen visit Oak Island twice in the documentary, and Crumpton in narration says, in relation to their second visit, quote, 2 years later, unquote. In their first visit, presumably at the permission of the Laginas, Crumpton and Amundsen, along with marine archaeologists, I don't know how to say his name, but I think it's Winan Barkin or something like that. I can't pronounce it. They float through the swamp and are probing the bottom near what they've identified as the Mercy Point in the Tree of Life. We've discussed this before, so I don't want to get into it too much. Note that the Mercy Point is right in what we now call the paved area. Crumpton says, and now he's going through quotes here, "It's the same height. It's like a flat surface." In Crumpton's following narration, he writes, "It seems there is a hard, flat area below us." Berkin, a marine archaeologist, tells us that he's never experienced such ground conditions in a swamp before. And then the archaeologist says, "I've never, ever felt solid, even ground. We're in the middle of a swamp here, and this is very definite hollow sound." Because Crumpton states that a later visit to Oak Island is 2 years after this particular one, this must have been perhaps around 2014. That's conjecture on my part, since the second visit must have come before 2017, considering the release date he's mentioning. Flash forward to the season of Curse of Oak Island. It's episode 91, The Torches Pass, the first episode of this season. The episode was aired on November 5th, 2019, and was presumably filmed during the 2019 search season on the island. They're bundled up, so this is perhaps in March or April of 2019. Here, diver Tony Sampson, accompanied by Rick Lagina, Craig Tester, and Steve Guptill, is waiting atop what we now call the paved area with a metal probe. He's poking down into it. Sampson says, "Got something here. That's weird. Solid." Sampson again says, "It's still going. Yep, further out." And then Craig Tester writes, "If it's man-made, that'd be huge being out in the swamp." There's more dialogue in episode 91, of course. But when watching the Crumpton documentary, I actually exclaimed aloud, "What? In no way do I mean to impugn the amazing and wonderful research work done by the Oak Island researchers. Is this really just dramatic effect by Prometheus, or perhaps an oversight? It seems to me that the paved area, though not exposed through draining and dredging until recently, was to some extent discovered and known as far back as maybe 2014. Would no one have thought to follow up for 5 years? It just makes me wonder how many things on the show we are not really, quote unquote, at the moment discoveries. Or are not really at the moment discoveries. Thanks, Steve." Okay, first of all, let me applaud you, Steve, for taking the time to research and write all of that out. I hope I read it well enough for all the listeners to follow the train of thought you're presenting here. But if not, like Steve said in his email, you can watch this documentary on Amazon Prime. And, you know, you can watch the whole thing for yourself. Also, the last time I checked, I think it was on YouTube, but I'm not so sure about that. But you can hunt around. It's out there. It's certainly a very well-produced and well-shot film. And I do suggest, if you're really interested in the Baconian theory and you're certainly a lover of Oak Island, you should go give it a try for yourself. Honestly, from my end, if I'm giving you a review or something, I find it kind of difficult to watch sometimes for many reasons, but let's not worry about that now. You can decide for yourself. We'll talk about it later on. Steve, from the best I can gather, you are absolutely correct in your interpretation of all this. If all the locations line up, like we both think they do, then yes, the possibility of the paved area goes back a few years at least. I suppose the best case scenario for all this, if we want to give the Laginas the full benefit of the doubt, is that they did know about the possible significance of this area of the swamp. They were indeed aware, either from their own work off camera or from Amundsen's work, they were aware of what was possibly a flattened section of the underground in the swamp. And perhaps they knew this as far back as 5 years ago, or maybe even more. But for a variety of reasons, all of which we can only guess at, they did not prioritize searching there right away. Now, instead, the team then turned their attention to other really big projects, like Smith's Cove, for instance. Then, when they finally did go back to it, the producers probably thought it best to act like this is completely new discovery, you know, for narrative reasons, or also for the sake of the many viewers who did not see Cracking the Shakespeare Code. If that's the case, you know, it certainly borders on the dishonest, I suppose, but you can see where they are coming from with that line of thinking. Also, I think it's important to note that we really don't know what the relationship between the Laginas and Amundsen is. It's very possible that the idea of bringing him back to the island to do essentially all this work he did in his documentary all over again for the television viewers was just never really an option. But who knows? If I were to guess, I would think there is a lot these guys know about the island and about the work done there, not only by themselves, but from other searchers before them. There's a lot they know that we, the viewer, never get to see or hear. Now, whether that is the decision of Rick and Marty or maybe Prometheus, who knows? Again, it would be kind of just a guess on our part to figure out what all of that means. Also, keep in mind, the Laginas don't really get involved much with the editing of the show, with, you know, the final finished product that we get to see on television every Tuesday night. Sure, they can pull the plug on this whole thing whenever they want, and they've actually threatened to do so in the past, when they felt the showrunners were possibly being dishonest. But at this point, with this kind of example, I don't know, I just think it would take something really egregious on the showrunners' part for them to ever do that. And can you blame them? In an interview from a few months back, Marty Lagina was asked about how the search is being paid for now, and this is asked by fans all the time, and he said, quote, "For the first several years, we, the Fellowship, put all the money in because the History Channel said, we'll film it, but it's your quest. As it became popular, they put money on the table, and they are paying for a decent chunk of it now. And I'll give you this, if you want an aggregate number, it's in the millions." Needless to say, I think Marty, Rick, and Craig, and the rest are probably okay with the producers sort of bending the timeline occasionally and employing what we might refer to as narrative choices. Thanks again for the email, Steve. And thanks to everyone who sent in an email. Great stuff, guys. If you would like to email me and have your question answered on a future podcast, just send it along to digginoakisland@gmail.com. So let's move into discussing this week's episode of The Curse of Oak Island called Lords of the Ring. It's amazing that that's not a copyright violation, but whatever. I'm also sure you picked up on how many times the narrator tried to tell us that, during this episode, that how the season is coming to an end. So be prepared, folks. There's only a couple episodes left to go here. We really only saw work being done on two sections of Oak Island in this episode, the Money Pit and the Swamp. So let's start off where the episode itself started off, over at the Money Pit. Since we last left the team, you know, in the last episode, they now have a huge 8-foot can oscillating its way into the ground in this new location being called OC1. The location the team was convinced would be the best shot ever taken at finding the original money pit. Right off the bat, we see the giant hammer grab pulling up all sorts of dirt and wood. And here we're told that progress is slow going due to the debris being left behind by what is called the Hedden Shaft. So I thought what we would do is take a second to tell you what the Hedden Shaft actually is, But before we can do that, we have to also tell you what the Chapel Vault is, because they're very connected. Now, I'm going to give you a short, abridged version of the story for these very two very important projects in the history and lore of the Oak Island Search. And I'm only going to do a abridged version because I really think both of these projects will make great subjects for an off-season podcast. So I want to save some of the details for later. In 1893, the Oak Island Treasure Company became the first group of searchers to take up digging on Oak Island in almost three decades. The time then, that three decades was the time when the original location of the money pit was lost. There were many investors in this Oak Island Treasure Company, as well as other experts and workers. They're all involved in the company. But the two men who became the most synonymous with Oak Island and with this group were Frederick Blair and William Chapel. William Chapel was a contractor from Sydney, Nova Scotia, when he was approached by Blair to join the hunt. And just for some context here on who he is the father of Mel Chapel, who would come to play a huge role in the Oak Island drama decades later, thanks in large part to his father's experiences there. I guess the Oak Island fever is apparently hereditary. William Chapel, the father, essentially took over as the man in charge of drilling operations for Frederick Blair and his company. In the summer of 1897, Chapel and his crew took another shot at getting to the bottom of the money pit. They had tried a couple times previously to this particular dig. They used pumps to keep the water at bay, and they got down to 90 feet where they set up what was essentially a drilling platform so they can run some exploratory holes further down the shaft. This becomes a popular idea. At 122 feet, they hit wood. And then at 126 feet, they hit iron, which the drill couldn't get through at first. So they reconfigured their gear they were using, and they were able then, you know, with something, I guess, with a different drill bit to pass through the iron. And then at 154 feet down, they struck what they call a 7-inch thick layer of cement, followed immediately by a 5-inch thick layer of solid oak. A foot further down, Chapel hit what he called loose metal. So imagine coins or that kind of thing, I guess. This was almost the same exact thing or same description that the Truro Company found in 1849, but they found it at around a depth of 100 feet. Of course, that was the Truro Company before the collapse of the money pit. So the theory here that we're working with is that the collapse caused whatever this was to be forced deeper underground. And the team examined the small pieces of stuff that came up at the end of the drill tip. And when they did that, they found the now famous piece of parchment. And I'm talking about Chapel here, found the now famous piece of parchment with the letters VI written in India ink. You've seen this 1,000 times on the show. Later, this concrete thing or whatever it was became known as the Chapel Vault. For many reasons, the same kinds of reasons that have stopped most other digs in their tracks, mainly money, the Oak Island Treasure Company never got all the way down to the vault, so therefore they never opened it up to see what it was. Now, fast forward a couple of decades to the mid-1930s, and Frederick Blair is still on Oak Island, still trying to get down to that very same vault. But this time, he's partnered with a rather rich businessman from New Jersey named Gilbert Hedden. The two began a couple of unsuccessful attempts to reach the now famous Chapel Vault. Just like Chapel before him, in one of these shafts, Hedden had his workers build what was essentially an iron drilling platform so he can do some exploratory holes further down. I believe they soon encountered what they assumed was the same layer of oak Chapel had found decades earlier, but the project was abandoned. And this time not for money reasons, but that's a different story for another day. This work done by Hedden and by Blair is all pretty well documented. So the Laginas and their partners were prepared to encounter the remnants of Hedden's work while digging themselves. And that's exactly what we see here in this scene. That's what they're pulling out. The team is finding much of the wood, much of the cribbing, they call it, that Hedden used to reinforce his shaft as he went down to that 90 feet. And then even a piece of that metal platform, that drill platform I mentioned earlier. So they got an idea of where they are. At one point, Rick says they're looking for what he calls hand-hewn timbers. I love that word. Meaning they're axe cut and not saw cut. So this might indicate that it's particularly old and pre-searcher in origin. He also comments that he hopes to, quote, find a chunk of wood big enough to dendro, referring again to that same wood dating process they used in Smith's Cove on the structures there. After getting down to a depth of 105 feet, the team then begins sifting carefully through the spoils coming up in the hammer grab. Drayton is all at it with his metal detector, and also piles of the spoils are apparently being moved over to this giant wash plant that the team had purchased before beginning work in Smith's Cove, I think at the beginning of last year. A wash plant is similar to what you see kind of gold prospectors use. What you do is you take large amounts of just earth dug in a bucket, you know, and you dump it all into the wash plant, and then it washes it all off and then separates the pieces of everything, mostly rocks, by size so you can kind of sift through them. Paul Troutman seems to be over there running the show at the wash plant, and as Rick Laginas shows up to ask him how it's going, Troutman remarks that they haven't found anything interesting, just pottery and glass. I think he said glass, certainly said pottery. It's hard to believe that finding pottery at more than 100 feet deep in the money pit area is now no longer of interest to the Laginas and their team. It just seems very strange to me. Later, after another hammer grab comes up, geologist Terry Matheson pulls out a carved piece of wood, which he described as looking like a piece of the top or bottom of a wood barrel. Now, one of the team, probably Doug Crawl, I can't remember, then remarks that a worker who dug shaft 6 also pulled out a piece of barrel coming from what they thought was the money pit. Now, the recreation and the narration of that event that follows here is really pretty silly, so let me just quickly tell you what they're referring to and give you an idea of shaft 6. Shaft 6 was dug in the early 1860s by a company called the Oak Island Association. It was another one of the many attempts that were done over the years to dig a hole next to the money pit and then tunnel horizontally across towards the area that they thought was the treasure vault, where they thought, you know, whatever was down there would be found. And this was all done in hopes of bypassing the booby trap flooding and thus getting to the goods, you know. This happened a lot back then, and it never worked, and it didn't work here either. As they dug towards the money pit, a lot of mud began flowing into shaft 6 and filling it up and then piling it up. Presumably, this was coming from the dirt at the bottom of the now water-filled money pit. It was while removing and looking through this mud that the workers found pieces of aged and hand-cut wood, including what looked like a part of a barrel or a keg. Not long after, the current team finds what Rick said he was looking for, a large piece of hand-cut timber. But that seems to be all they ever find. They keep digging down more and more, getting down towards the bedrock, and really, they kind of come up empty. The so-called best attempt at finding the original money pit location turns out to be another frustrating failure on Oak Island. A new location will need to be found if they're going to dig again this season at all. So later in the episode, Rick, Doug and Dave Blankenship are over at Dan Blankenship's old office looking through his records. In what honestly looked to me like a sort of a desperate attempt to find something, really anything that might point them in the direction of a good place to dig. Basically, after all this, they decide to go after finding this shaft 6 so that, again, they can try to make another attempt at triangulating the location of the money pit. But considering how much damage we already know was done to this shaft, it certainly seems like something of a long shot at best to me. What began as an incredibly promising project ends as just another hole in Oak Island. As the episode finishes up, Vanessa Lucido and her crew begin dropping a new can in the location the team thinks must be Shaft 6. And this gives me time to mention something else. Before, we talked about how the narrator and specifically the writing for the narration can really bug the heck out of me, but yet I'm able to get past it. Well, sometimes I'm not able to get past it, and there's no better example of that than this. As the credits roll, I hear what might very well be the worst piece of writing I've ever heard from the narrator on this show, as Clotworthy asks, "Will they find that the closer they get to revealing Oak Island secrets, the closer they are to putting themselves in the path of its deadly curse?" With these incredibly cheesy sound effects added to the deadly curse bit. Now, like I said, even though I've kind of learned to live with it, it can still be pretty tough to stomach sometimes. Okay, as I mentioned before, we only really saw two locations this week on the show, the Money Pit and the Swamp. So let's head over to the swamp to wrap this podcast up. We see Gary Drayton with his metal detector, along with Rick Lagina and a shovel, heading down to search the drained out swamp. The two unearth another of Drayton's famous top pocket finds, a rather ornate looking ring. Maybe not that ornate, actually, when you think about it. My first impression is that it was a big design. You know, it was really, looked in really in incredibly good shape for being stuck in a bog for however long. I mean, we're assuming it's been there for centuries. It looked in really good shape. And that it probably looked like it was brass or maybe copper. Also, the fact that it didn't have a gem or a stone in it of any kind, and obviously never did, made me think it wasn't all that valuable, even when it was first made, but I'm not a jewelry expert. What do I know? It's pretty obvious Drayton didn't agree with my assessment because he went absolutely nuts over it, high-fiving Rick and exclaiming how they're back in business. If nothing else, I got a hand to Gary. He is certainly enthusiastic. Later, Rick and Gary take the ring to their research office, call it interpretive center or something like that, to show it to Marty Lagina, who is there with archaeologist Laird Niven, and a guy who is a historic objects conservator named Kelly Barassa, who we saw introduced earlier. Basically, in this area, Laird and Kelly are cleaning up the artifacts they find and doing their best to get great pictures and do that kind of stuff. Now, the two experts here note how physically small this ring is. And you can really get a good idea of its size when you see the close-up of the ring as Laird is holding it, and then you can kind of compare it there to his thumb. I mean, it's really small. Barassa says it looks rather feminine to him, I think in kind of like who would have had this. And someone even offers up that it might have been for a child or for a little girl or something like that. Now, Gary pushes back on this a bit, saying that people had smaller hands centuries ago, which I suppose might be true to some degree. But I'm not sure an adult's finger would have been that small even back then, but who knows? Look at that close-up again, though. It is really, really tiny. So be that as it may, the guys put the ring under a microscope and they think it looks a bit like silver or might even have some, you know, maybe more than one metal in its compositional makeup. They can see kind of two different distinct types of corrosion. Now, for the most part, each metal corrodes into sort of a different color. So that kind of makes sense to me that you can see that. Although they didn't really do a whole lot of cleaning up, so who knows. The editing here also is a bit choppy in this scene, so it's hard to really get a good idea of what Barassa and Laird Niven are actually thinking about this. Plus, the narrator comes in and distracts us with questions about whether or not this is an example of possible treasure found on Oak Island with really little evidence of what this ring's value might be. Niven and Barassa say things like it's weird, you know, that kind of thing. They think it's unusual looking, but the editing seems to leave out much of the reasons why they think it's weird, so who really knows? There might be a good reason that they left that stuff out with the editing. Just hang on a second. I'll get to that in a second. So the team sends the ring off to a gemology expert, a man named Professor Charles Luton Brain at the Alberta College of Arts and Design in Calgary. Now, we've seen and discussed the professor before. I'm sure I already pointed out in a previous podcast how great the name Brain is for a professor, but it always bears repeating, Professor Brain. Can't come up with a name like that on your own. Anyway, he thinks he sees evidence of two crude repairs done on the back of the ring, just at the very, very back of it. These repairs were most likely done for sizing reasons. He said, I think one to make it smaller and one to make it bigger. Thus, this is the multiple metals that Laird Niven and Kelly Barassa thought they were seeing earlier under the microscope. Brain says that they were done quickly and done crudely, so that might mean that they weren't done with a whole lot of care about matching things and matching designs. Anyway, we'll get back to this. The ring, according to him, appears to be made of bronze, or I think he said some kind of silver-contented copper alloy or something like that. But he doesn't actually have the ring in his possession to look at. He's only assuming this from what he sees in these photos. Again, it's incredible here that they don't send him the ring, but we might have an answer to that in a second. He's also, Brain, I'm talking about here, Professor Brain, taken by how the main floral design was made. It's his determination that the design itself was chiseled into the ring, which is a method not really used after 1730 when the technology changed for making these kind of things. He also feels that the design looks very European in origin to him, possibly Spanish. So we now have, from this expert, a possible date and even maybe a place of origin. Or do we? I'm going to do something here I hardly ever do. Let me tell you a little story, just in case you are not someone who follows or participates in the many Oak Island social media groups and that sort of thing. This past weekend, 4 or 5 days or so before this episode aired, I was scrolling through my Facebook news feed and came across a stunning photo that just stopped me in my tracks. That was posted by a member of one of these Oak Island fan groups. It was of a ring that looks, and I am not exaggerating here in the least, exactly the same as this ring that Gary Drayton found in the swamp. Now, only it, you know, obviously it looks a little different because it was in somebody's drawer and not underground in a swamp, so it's a lot cleaner and shinier, but you really see just how incredibly close these two are. I'll post a screenshot of the original photo and the posting that this fan wrote on our Diggin' Oak Island Facebook and Twitter pages so you can see this for yourself. Once you see it, I think you too might be floored here. Now, I'm sure for some of you, your first reaction might be, you know, that this is a fake. Someone who knows how to do this kind of thing made this ring for themselves after seeing the preview last week and then posted it. But look at the back of the Facebook ring. Look at the quote-unquote repair that's done there. If it's not an exact match, and I think it is very, very close. Now remember, this was posted days before this week's show was aired. And last week's preview, which would be all this person had to go on if they were to fake this, didn't show the back of the ring found in the swamp. Now, so basically what I'm saying is, try as you might to poke holes in this ring online here, as far as I'm concerned, these two rings are a match, or at least incredibly close to a match. But I'm not the judge and jury here. You, the listeners of this podcast, and especially viewers of The Curse of Oak Island, are the only people who can be the judge and jury. What do you think? Take a look at this. Email me. Post your thoughts on the Facebook or Twitter pages. Tell me what you think. What do we have here? What are we looking at? If this other ring, the one from the Facebook fan, is genuine, and I can, listen, I can only take the owner at their word right here. There's no way I can verify it. All I can do is present it to you and the timeline and all of that. But if this is genuine, then the ring Gary Drayton and Rick Lagina found in the swamp is nothing more than modern costume jewelry, I suppose. How can two archaeologists, this is the real question, how could two archaeologists and a gemology professor be so wrong in their conclusion? Now listen, having said all this, I'm really trying hard not to pass judgment here. I'm really trying to keep everything open on what this is and what this all means. I just don't have anywhere near the information to do that yet. But I kind of felt that having seen that ring and then having seen the show and compared the two, that you guys, you my listeners, you the fans of The Curse of Oak Island needed to see this and be able to judge for yourself. Let's see where this all goes from here. We might not have heard the end of it. So that's going to do it for this episode of Diggin' Oak Island. Another shameless plug for you, which I've done the last couple of weeks. I produce another podcast. It's called Sit Downs and Sessions. Me and my friend, radio host Chris Poe, sit down over a drink or two, and we talk about pubs and the paranormal. We do a little politics now and then, that kind of stuff. It's kind of a catch-all, just sort of two guys sitting around a bar having a chat. Give it a listen. You can find it at Sit Downs and Sessions on iTunes and all the podcast places. Also, if you're enjoying Diggin' Oak Island, I ask that you please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And a big thank you to everyone who has left us a rating so far, a 5-star rating. I really do appreciate it. Thank you for taking the time to do that. And of course, thank you especially for the kind words on our show. Don't forget, you can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter, as I mentioned. You can find us at Diggin' Oak Island. And again, if you have any questions or comments that you want to send directly to me, you can do so via email, digginoakisland@gmail.com. And just keep in mind, I say this every week because I want you to be clear, if you do send me an email or even a direct message via social media, please keep in mind that I may just answer it here on the podcast. So if you don't want your message read, just please make a note of that for me and I'll do my best to answer it, you know, just between you and I. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Digging Oak Island.